What's up, rockers? Welcome. My name is DJ Blue, and you're listening to The Journey Through Rock right here on Penguin Radio. So, today I want to cover a revolution of rock music that completely altered the future of rock and roll, and that is the British Invasion. So, to refresh everyone's mind, the big thing in the music industry at this time was sounds like rockabilly, surf sound, and teen idols who first introduced the idea of rock and roll in the US. And the public either loved the rise of this new music and producers and culture, or they had a negative view as they focused more on the dance craze it created instead. So at this time, the US was looking for the next Elvis, or the next big sensation to kind of carry on rock music. But what no one really expected was that the next Elvis actually came from the UK as a band known as The Beatles, who began dominating the charts in the early 60s. So as you may know it, The Beatles consisted of John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr. They formed in Liverpool after John Lennon recruited Paul McCartney and his band called The Quarrymen. They eventually changed their name to The Beatles as a tribute to Buddy Holly and the Crickets, who named their band after a bug, and it also related to the Beat Movement. So The Beatles' music, as they started off, rooted from skiffle music. It included a drummerless band with an acoustic guitar, banjo. It was more related to American folk song with basic tunes. And this music style mixed with the Beat Movement, which was a literature movement in the 1950s with underdogs. They believed in the rejection of standard American values and really focused more on religions and spirituality and deeper meaning of the human condition. So the Beatles were also influenced by many popular artists at this time, such as Elvis, Little Richard, Chuck Berry, Buddy Holly, the Everly Brothers. But what they did that was different was they expanded their music styles. That being said, the Beatles tended to explore music styles ranging from ballads, Indian music, psychedelia, classical, pop music, hard rock, and many more. They sort of became innovators as they experimented with so many drastically different sounds, making them the most influential rock band of all time. So, the Beatles were signed by Brian Epstein in the early 60s, and were picked up by producer George Martin. And they were naturally seen as a humble and charming group, and they weren't really seen as sophisticated either in the UK, which is why they were so admired, because they're kind of seen as a common person. They began playing in a famous club in Liverpool known as the Cavern Club, as well as in Germany, before their debut to the US in 1964. 1963 was actually their huge breakthrough year, with their hit singles such as She Loves You, which became the first single to sell 750,000 copies in under 4 weeks, and the first single to sell 1 million copies, and the biggest selling record in the UK until 1978. So the term Beatlemania was coined as they were constantly greeted by enthusiastic screaming fans pretty much everywhere they went, kind of like Elvis was. The song I Want to Hold Your Hand was their breakthrough song in the United States in 1963. It was a number one hit as it became the first year where British slots were seen on American music charts. In 1964, the Beatles came to America to perform on the Ed Sullivan Show, and at this particular show, it was noted that it had the largest audience ever recorded on an American television program, with 34% of the American population watching. And a quick fun fact is, crime was actually at an all-time low at the time that the Beatles came to America. So naturally, George Harrison made a joke about it and stated, "Even the criminals stopped for a minute to watch the Beatles on TV." So the reason that the Beatles gained lots of popularity and attention at this time, along with their charisma, was the Beatles were talented enough to play covers of famous songs exactly like their records. I mean, for example, it was difficult for listeners to tell whether the Beatles were playing a cover of an Elvis song or if it was actually Elvis himself until they started singing. This was because they sounded so similar, and the Beatles were able to match Elvis's unique instrumentals as so well, along with several other artists. They eventually became bigger than what anyone had imagined, which really sort of opened the doors and opportunities for other British bands, and that is what created the British Invasion in the 1960s. They actually went on to make several movies, and even cartoons were made based on them. One of their first popular albums was also a movie. The album was titled Help, which really, this album really expanded the use of vocal overdubs in classical instruments. In fact, there was a string quartet on the pop ballad Yesterday. This song was composed and sung by Paul McCartney and is known today as one of the most covered songs in history. So with this album, the Beatles became the first rock group to be nominated for a Grammy Award for Album of the Year. When the Beatles finally went on tour, they were introduced to many influential artists such as Bob Dylan and Elvis, and they were also introduced to other qualities that kind of influenced their music in the future. They started experimenting with things like psychedelic drugs, which really motivated them, or inspired them, I should say, to also experiment with new types of music and albums. So they're attempting to make it as an art of them rather than a copy. I mean, when the Beatles first got big, it was because they're imitating other artists' styles, as I mentioned. But once they gained popularity and credentials, they could become the innovators of new music by experimenting rather than imitating music. And this concept of experimentation first started out with their album Rubber Soul. This album expanded with deeper aspects of romance, philosophy, and deeper meaning, unlike what they were making before. Paul McCartney actually stated that we'd had our cute period and now it was time to expand. However, one thing to note was that at this time, it was dangerous for musicians to experiment, especially culturally. If you remember, at this time, the media really wanted to control what was being given out to the public and younger generations. Also around this time, the Beatles released an album titled Yesterday and Today, in which they dressed in butcher's overalls and were surrounded by raw meat and mutilated plastic baby dolls on their album cover. Now, today, people wouldn't really think much of this, just like the Beatles didn't think much of it when it was released. However, they did receive lots of backlash for this, as the public sort of took offense to it, thinking the Beatles were making fun of them in some way, kind of mocking them. Another example, they also received backlash from religious and social conservatives in the US after the group took a trip to India and the Philippines, where they partook in their religious values. So at this time, this was looked down upon because Christianity was the leading religion in the United States. So once they returned to the country did take offense to this. But the interesting thing about the Beatles is they did not care about backlash. In fact, as a response to this negative criticism, John Lennon stated, "We're more popular than Jesus now. I don't know which will go first, rock and roll or Christianity." I mean, the Beatles were not afraid to fight back to the criticism, and that is one thing that is noted in their careers as a group and as individual artists, is they never really cracked down to society's pressure or expectations. Instead, they stuck to what they thought was right, regardless of their public image and influence they had on the public. They tended to use their influential voices to speak up and address topics that musicians didn't really talk about at this time, such as politics. And this really sparked a cultural movement, especially in the 60s and 70s, with the numerous progressive movements that occurred. Alright, so with their rising peak of experimentation, the Beatles released Revolver a week before their final tour. This album featured studio experimentation and the first real experimentation with psychedelia. Unfortunately, none of these songs were performed on tour because as the Beatles were preparing for their next US tour, they realized that their live music was not going to be able to be heard because of how loud their audiences were during their concerts. After 100 watt amplifiers in larger venues, the Beatles realized that since their singing can't be heard at live events, their shows really weren't about their music anymore and decided to stop touring. Their last commercial concert was actually at Candlestick Park in 1966, after 4 years of non-stop touring. So as a result of not touring anymore, the Beatles were able to really focus on increasing their experimental approach with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. This album was part of the revolutionary psychedelic rock movement, and we will actually discuss this album more in depth in regards to that rock genre, along with the band's spiritual trip to India in the future. But sadly, after this album was made, the group's individual differences were becoming more apparent. I mean, McCartney seemed to be more interested in pop styles of music, while Harrison wanted to practice Indian music and religion, while Lennon was more into introspective and experimental music. And it kind of seemed like the one thing keeping the band together towards the end of their career and finding a way to compromise these musical differences was their manager, Brian Epstein. So after Epstein passed away in 1967, the Beatles found it difficult to hold it together as a group, and they sort of lost their leader, so each member kind of began to go their own ways. This was extremely evident in the making of their last albums. I mean, although the White Album sold the most copies in the US and Abbey Road sold 4 million copies in 3 months, it was obvious that the band was pretty much over after this. So finally, on January 30th, 1969, the Beatles decided to perform one last unannounced concert from the rooftop of their Apple Corps headquarters in London. They ended up playing a 42-minute set before the police arrived and told them to keep it down, making it the final public performance of their career and the end of an era. Now, we will discuss more of the Beatles and other shows as we get more in depth with their experimental music. But now I want to cross over to the mutineer band of the British invasion, the Rolling Stones, which will be discussed right after this quick break. My name is DJ Blue, and you're listening to The Journey Through Rock, right here on Penguin Radio. Welcome back, rockers. My name is DJ Blue, and you're listening to The Journey Through Rock, right here on Penguin Radio. We just discussed the Beatles' journey through fame, but now I want to turn the attention over to the other band that sort of set the tone for the British invasion, the Rolling Stones. So the Stones were predominantly led by Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, and also had members come and go, but the original third member was Brian Jones. So they experimented with a variety of music, much like the Beatles. They tended to play blues rock, rhythm and blues, folk, psychedelic, and so on. And Brian Jones actually used the slide guitar to play, which was not common at this time, and the group also pioneered a sort of gritty, heavier-driven sound that eventually came to define hard rock in the future. So, Keith Richards and Mick Jagger were actually childhood friends and classmates in 1950 in Dartford, Kent. In 1961, they rekindled and began a musical partnership by playing blues songs from artists like Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley. So at first, they would only play cover songs that they didn't really write their own music. It wasn't until they wrote the song The Last Time where their lyrical careers really took off. And the group's acting manager at the time initially wanted the Stones to imitate the Beatles by having them wear the same suits, have the same hair, but then he actually changed his mind and instead thought to make the band the complete opposite of the Beatles. He encouraged the Stones to wear unmatched clothing, have long hair, a more messy appearance, because he wanted to make the Stones more unpredictable, unlike many other British bands at this time. Their manager, Andrew Loog Oldham, eventually started promoting headlines such as, "Would you let your daughter marry a Rolling Stone?" So they were really the first group to kind of break away from the traditional identical uniforms and good image that other bands like the Beatles caved to society when they first started out. So as a result of this, the Stones sort of became known as the bad boys in the United States because they were the total opposite of the Beatles. I mean, the Beatles already developed a witty, more charming, good boy image, at least at the first half of their career, whereas the Stones immediately started smoking, drinking, and just seemed more sloppy in a way. And this kind of ties back to how Elvis was being seen in the 1950s. Artists like Pat Boone had a good image to society, while Elvis was seen as the more rebellious one. So, of course, the Stones' audience were rebellious crowds at this time period, the crowds that caused trouble and exhausted police during shows. But surprisingly, when the Stones arrived to the US, they actually had a really tough time getting settled compared to the Beatles. They didn't even have a hit record in the United States yet, and just weren't really popular for a while when they got here. It wasn't until their second UK LP album, The Rolling Stones No. 2, where they became successful and reached number one on the charts. Their first international hit was I Can't Get No Satisfaction, as it hit number one in the US and was on the Billboard Hot 100 for 4 weeks. But even so, this song came with lots of controversy from the public. And this was because society kind of had the question in mind, you know, you can't get satisfaction of what exactly? So since it wasn't directly mentioned in the lyrics, the public sort of filled in the blank space. So although the Stones were getting a bad reputation, it just got worse as they were constantly being accused of partying and drug use. Their parties were always raided by the police, most of the members got arrested, which kind of interfered with their music. I mean, they constantly had to await court trials and dates and deal with all the criticism in the midst of them attempting to record new music and perform. Even one of their albums, titled Their Satanic Majesty's Request, you know, although this album reached number 3 in the UK and number 2 in the US, it had bad reviews because it was seen as a poor imitation of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. In fact, this is an unpopular opinion, but people believe that the Stones are sort of overshadowed by the Beatles at this time and didn't really peak until the late 70s. When the Stones released Beggar's Banquet, Brian Jones was apparently not suited to touring anymore, which interrupted tour plans. Jones was taking too many drugs, he was unable to obtain a US visa, he was just not fit to be on the road again. In 1969, unfortunately, Jones drowned under mysterious circumstances in his swimming pool. And this had this was huge news for the Stones, so that in their next performance in London, the Stones actually dedicated that whole show to Jones and even released thousands of butterflies in his memory. Another tragic incident that Richards and Jagger had to endure, it was right after the US tour ended, they decided to perform at the Altamont Free Concert at the Altamont Speedway in 1969. So this whole show was kind of considered the West Coast of Woodstock. It was about 4 months after Woodstock. It was a big deal. Big artists such as The Grateful Dead, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Santana, they were all playing here. So, at this show, a fan named Meredith Hunter was stabbed to death by one of Hell's Angels biker gang. This was and still is considered one of the most disastrous moments in rock, as it sort of shattered the spirits of these new cultural movements at this time, like Woodstock and rock and roll. With all these incidents, the Stones really did endure lots of hardships throughout their career. They've been heavily criticized by their style and music, and they had to make a comeback after two significant deaths. I mean, it kind of shows how strong they were as a group by sticking together and getting through it together and continuing on with their careers. Alright, so, everyone knows the Rolling Stones' famous logo. You got the red mouth with a tongue sticking out, and you pretty much see it on most Stones merchandise today. So, the interesting thing about this logo is it was originally made for the album Sticky Fingers. The original design was a photograph of a man from the waist down with an unzipped zipper. When it was being sold, it actually received lots of controversy, so they had to make another one and kind of find an alternative for their cover. Thankfully, a guy named John Pasch created the new design that we know of today that became known as the most famous logo in the history of popular music. And a fun fact is, Pasch actually came up with this logo as he was inspired by the Hindu goddess Kali. So, towards the second half of the Stones' career, in the late 70s actually, punk music began to gain more popularity, which meant the Stones were kind of seen as outdated. They weren't really the hot gossip anymore. Thankfully, the Stones were saved by their album, Some Girls, and that contains some of the most popular songs that they have today, such as Miss You and Beast of Burden. This album was sort of the Stones' response to the punk uprising. The Stones decided to alter their music style and put in more fast, guitar-driven sounds, which is what appealed to the younger generation at this time, making it the number 2 album in the UK and number 1 in the US. Along with this album came another album, Tattoo You, with their famous Start Me Up, which became number 2 in the US. And this is really where the Stones were at the very peak of their career, as I mentioned. They were not receiving as much backlash anymore, and people really liked them. But unfortunately, after these two albums, Richards and Jagger did begin to drift apart, as Jagger became more of a solo artist. He teamed up with other artists, such as David Bowie, for future songs. However, in the midst of the British invasion, the Stones did set the tone for other bands, much like the Beatles did. But since these two bands are so drastically different from each other, as I mentioned, the Stones were seen as the bad guys, while the Beatles were seen as the good guys. So any British group that was part of the British invasion were kind of divided into two categories. They were either in the Beatles group, and these bands usually had a song and vocals emphasis, they're more smoother and more professional, or they were put into the Stones group, with a more blues-influenced, grittier sound, less production value. And this is what made up the British invasion. The Beatles and Stones were the ones who sort of set the tone, and so many bands that are similar to them is the bands that kind of made it big in the US. If you're anything like the Stones or the Beatles, you will make it here. And we will be talking about these individual bands right after this break. My name is DJ Blue, and you're listening to The Journey Through Rock, right here on Penguin Radio. Welcome back, rockers. My name is DJ Blue, and you're listening to The Journey Through Rock, right here on Penguin Radio. So now that we've talked about the significance that the Beatles and the Stones had on the British invasion, we will now talk about the bands who followed in their footsteps. As I mentioned before, these bands split into two categories under Beatles type and Stones type. And I'm now going to start with the Beatles type bands and Gerry and the Pacemakers. So Gerry and the Pacemakers were the second band to be managed by Brian Epstein and produced by George Martin, along with the Beatles. They also originated in Liverpool and were led by Gerry Marsden. Their hit breakthrough song was How Do You Do It? This song reached number 1 in the UK. And another song they're known for was one of Gerry's favorite songs growing up, is You'll Never Walk Alone. And for you soccer fans out there, this song actually became a signature tune of the famous Liverpool Football Club to this day. It's one of the most famous soccer clubs in the world. So unlike the Beatles and the Stones, Gerry and the Pacemakers were known for their happy music with simple lyrics, very nice to listen to. In other words, they never really expanded their music or voice, much like the Beatles. And Gerry actually stated, "We didn't try to change the world." So I guess it wasn't really their thing to try to influence their media through their music. So as a result, they never really grew after their first few hit songs and disbanded in October of 1966. However, a bit more successful, Herman's Hermits. Herman's Hermits formed in 1964 in Manchester, and they're ranked as one of the most successful acts in the Beatles-led British invasion. A vocalist of the band, Peter Noon, was known for his awesome accent as he sang. He actually took this as an advantage by exaggerating words during songs to kind of create a thicker accent and gaining more of an audience. Right here, I'll show a quick clip of his song, Sunshine Girl, where you could hear his accent. My sunshine girl, sunshine girl, now I must go away, 'cause this was only a summer holiday, but one day I'll be returning, you'll see. So Herman's Hermits' name actually came from a resemblance between Noon and Sherman from Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons. Eventually, Sherman turned into Herman, which kind of inspired their name. Their hit song was I'm Into Something Good, and this reached number 1 in the UK and number 13 in the US. But like a lot of bands at this time, a lot of their hit songs were covers from other artists such as Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones of Zeppelin and Bobby Graham, which sort of made it difficult for them to reach higher success especially after Noon left the group in 1971. However, one of the few groups in the British invasion that did not really disperse after a few years was the Hollies. The Hollies consisted of Alan Clark and Graham Nash, who were friends in primary school, and they formed in Manchester in 1962. They're actually known for their distinctive three-part harmony vocal style. They called themselves the Hollies after the music legend Buddy Holly, as well as Christmas, according to Nash. Their first song was, first hit song, was Bus Stop, which reached number 5 in the UK and number 5 in the US, and it was the first US top 10 single. Unfortunately, in 1968, Graham Nash decided to move to LA to become a singer-songwriter. But in LA, he did meet and joined David Crosby, where they hit it off and decided to start a band known as Crosby, Stills, and Nash. After Nash left, however, the rest of the band continued playing and ended up making more hit songs in the 70s and 80s, as they featured other huge artists in their songs, such as Elton John. So, one last group or duo that I want to quickly discuss in the Beatles-type category band is British pop duo Peter and Gordon. So, this duo received international fame with their huge one-hit wonder single, also their first single, A World Without Love. This song was released in 1964 and reached number 1 in the US and the UK and became a million-dollar single. But what lots of people know about this song is that they didn't write it. Peter Asher and his sister Jane Asher, who played siblings in the 1955 episode television series The Adventures of Robin Hood, this particular sister dated Paul McCartney between 1963 and 1968. The song A World Without Love was actually written by Paul and was supposed to be a Beatles song. Eventually, Paul sold it over to Peter and Gordon, where they credited the song as Lennon-McCartney. So, thank you, Paul McCartney, for that iconic song. So, this will conclude the Beatles-type bands of the British invasion, but now I want to switch it over to the Stones-type bands, more grittier, heavier sound. So, unlike the other bands we just discussed, these bands tended to have more successful careers after the British invasion. And I would like to start off with the one with the most history, which is the Yardbirds. So the Yardbirds were formed in the London suburbs in 1963 and are known for having three iconic, influential musicians who are later going to become huge. You may know them as Eric Clapton, Jimmy Page, and Robert Plant. So the Yardbirds were known for pioneering psychedelic rock and early hard rock. Their song, Shape of Things, is known as one of the first psychedelic rock classics. They also experienced with European and Asian styles, as well as Middle Eastern styles of music. One of their guitarists, Jeff Beck, used a fuzz-toned guitar riff on his hit single, Heartful of Soul, which sort of helped introduce Indian-influenced guitar strings to the pop charts in 1965. So as you may know it, the Yardbirds actually don't get enough credit for the influence that they have on the future of rock and roll. The band's last show together was actually in 1968, as the band dispersed, but Jimmy Page was the one who decided to keep going with the band and not give up. So, Jimmy Page decided to take a tour of Scandinavia and picked up Robert Plant, as well as his childhood friend John Bonham on the way, and bassist and keyboardist John Paul Jones. Together, these guys went on a Scandinavian tour as the new Yardbirds and eventually went off to produce their debut Led Zeppelin album. So the next band I want to talk about, led by Eric Burdon, The Animals. They found fame in 1964 and are known for their gritty, bluesy sound and deep-voiced frontman, Eric Burdon. The name Animals was dubbed as a tribute to one of the group's friend named Animal Hog, according to Eric Burdon. Their hit song, as everyone knows it today, The House of the Rising Sun, released in 1964, just as they started out as a band. So with Burdon's sort of howling vocals and dramatic arrangement, and Alan Price's kind of unique riffs on his guitar, this is actually arguably considered the first folk rock hit. The song impressed many different artists within the folk rock subgenre, such as Bob Dylan, and is kind of ultimately what makes The Animals so well known today, is this song, as it is still super popular today, which evidently made them really excited about their famous songs, as reporters always noted that they could never stop talking about this song and its success throughout their entire careers. So one last group I want to discuss within the Stones type genre is Cream. Cream formed in London in 1966 with Jack Bruce as the primary songwriter and vocalist, guitarist Eric Clapton and drummer Ginger Baker. This band formed after each of these musicians saw each other play and were actually really impressed with each other and decided to create a band. Their band name came from these guys considering themselves the cream on top against blues and jazz musicians uprising at this time. Their huge album was Disraeli Gears, released in 1967, and combined British rock with American blues. This album contains their hit song, Sunshine of Your Love, which became known as Cream's unofficial anthem. And a fun fact is, this song was written in the midst of a desperate, tiresome, long night in Bruce's apartment. So, just as the guys were getting ready to call it a night, Bruce began playing a riff on his guitar while Brown looked out the window to see the sun rising. Brown stated out loud, "It's getting near dawn." He thought about it and decided to write, "When the lights close their tired eyes." So unfortunately, while these guys were all very talented and well-liked by the public, what people really didn't know was that Bruce and Baker were known for constantly quarreling throughout the band's career. This started to lead to on-stage fighting and sabotaging of each other's instruments. Clapton was actually known as the peacekeeper between the two, but after the antagonism between Bruce and Baker kind of created too much tension for Clapton, he became tired of it and the band did break up in 1968. And this is where I'm going to leave you for another quick break. Up next, I'm going to talk about the two groups that played a huge role in the British invasion and the only two groups who really didn't fit into any of these categories of Beatles or Stone type bands. My name is DJ Blue, and you're listening to The Journey Through Rock, right here on Penguin Radio. What's up, rockers? Welcome back. My name is DJ Blue, and you're listening to The Journey Through Rock, right here on Penguin Radio. So now that we went over the categorized groups of the British invasion, I want to bring an emphasis over on two groups who didn't really fit into a category, mainly because they're sort of their own thing. They had more powerful and aggressive music and more clever and thoughtful lyrics compared to the other groups. You guys may know them as The Kinks and The Who. So getting right into it with The Kinks. The Kinks formed in North London in 1964 by brothers Ray and Dave Davies. Influenced by American rhythm and blues, British music hall, folk, and country, they were encouraged to name the band Kinky as a way to gain more attention when they first started off. The word kinkiness was just borderline accepted by society without them getting criticized for it. But the band members were actually really horrified by this idea. Ray Davies actually stated that he never actually really liked the name to begin with. So as the band started out, they found it difficult to make it on the charts despite their hit song You Really Got Me, released in 1964. But when the band recorded the original version of this song, it was much slower and not too exciting as the one we know of today. They knew they could make the song better and they knew it was a good song, so they re-recorded it and added in a loud, distorted guitar riff solo by Dave, which kind of gave it more signature, gritty guitar sound and made it number one on the charts in the UK. So after their careers began to blossom in 1965, we kind of began to see a notable stylistic shift to their music, which was seen in songs such as Dedicated Follower of Fashion and A Well-Respected Man. And this is where we began to see Dave Davies's unique songwriting style, and this is what the Kinks are really known for. They went from more of a hard-driven rock to a more social commentary, observation, and character study in their lyrics. And this is what set them apart from other bands in the British Invasion, is that they kind of told a story in their lyrics about everyday life and people, specifically in the UK or London. So this unique lyrical style was prominent in their next album, Face to Face, as well as one of their next hit singles, Waterloo Sunset. Waterloo Sunset is about two lovers passing over a bridge with an observer reflecting on the couple. Ray actually mentioned that this song was actually about his sister who was immigrating to another country with her boyfriend. Today, this song is known as one of the most beautiful songs in the rock and roll era. After the band quit touring in 1968, Dave Davies began doing solo work and released songs such as Death of a Clown, which ultimately gave the band more popularity and recognition. However, they couldn't remain successful due to uncooperative promoters and disinterested audiences, along with Ray Davies suffering of depression that made him sick of all the pressure from being a musician. But, thankfully, the band's name was saved in 1970, actually by other local, or other huge bands, I should say, who were popular at that time, and they began to make covers of the Kinks' songs. For example, Van Halen made a popular cover of Where Have All the Good Times Gone, while the Pretenders covered Stop Your Sobbing. And this actually made the Kinks peak again in the 70s and 80s, and kind of spark up their careers enough to make a couple more hit songs throughout the 80s, such as Come Dancing, released in 1983 and was number 6 on the US charts. So, now that we've covered the Kinks' unique careers with music, one last band that I want to talk about is The Who. The Who formed in London in 1964 with their classic lineup, Roger Daltrey, Pete Townshend, and John Entwistle, and Keith Moon. They are known for selling over 100 million records worldwide. They developed the use of the synthesizer in rock opera. The Who was also known for really focusing on their image. They started off by representing a growing mod movement in Britain at this time, which included raggy fashion, scooters, music genres from soul and beat movements, and this was their main audience because several of the members of this band were mods kids growing up. These groups often felt misunderstood by society and were kind of seen as outcasts. So The Who were actually known for smashing their guitars and drums on stage, which at this time no other band did, and this kind of brought out their destructive behavior, or as they called it, destructive art. Their representation for the mod movement was also seen in their songs, such as their single My Generation, which was a powerful song due to Entwistle's bass solo, and the song used gimmicks such as a vocal stutter to stimulate the speech of a mod on amphetamines. So this was a huge hit in the UK, making it to number 2 in the chart. And these little gimmicks and references to mods made them admired by the mod group teens at this time, as they felt understood, at least by The Who. But in the late 1960s, the mod movement did begin to diminish, which meant that The Who had to face tough competition against other groups such as Cream or the Jimi Hendrix Experience. The Who really didn't fit into the whole new hippie movement that was becoming popular. But one of the things that saved The Who's career was Townshend's introduction to Indian spirituality, and this concept was focused around their production of their hit double album, Tommy. An album about a deaf, dumb, and blind boy and his attempt to communicate with others. So Townshend actually wanted the album to go beyond a rock album and have more of a spiritual concept behind the music, which motivated him to make this into a rock opera. This way he was able to expand on just having a rock hit single, but rather having an album with deeper meaning and a story behind it. The Tommy album sold over 200,000 copies within the first 2 weeks of its release, and was a major success. Life magazine actually stated, "For sheer power, invention, and brilliance of performance, Tommy outstrips anything which has ever come out of a recording studio." So this album ultimately made The Who's entire career. They secured their future and made them millionaires, and by the 1970s, there was actually a Tommy film which included the cast, Anne Margaret, Oliver Reed, Eric Clapton, Tina Turner, Elton John, and Jack Nicholson, a lot of huge artists in this cast. So the film premiered on March 18th, 1975 to a standing ovation. Townshend was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Original Score, and it won the award for Rock Movie of the Year in the first annual Rock Music Awards, and it generated over $2 million in its first month. But unfortunately, after the success of this movie and album, Townshend became tired of touring as the group endured poor relationships, and the only true friendship in the band was actually between Entwistle and Moon. And although they did make a lot of hit songs throughout their career, they never really peaked after the production of Tommy. So The Who did leave a huge legacy in rock and roll with their rock opera production. They influenced other bands with similar concepts such as Pink Floyd and Jimi Hendrix. And, you know, this will conclude today's radio show. Next week, we'll be moving on to the rise of folk rock in the U.S. Thank you for listening, rockers. My name is DJ Blue, and you're listening to The Journey Through Rock, right here on Penguin Radio.